Well, I get pig-headed and I drink too much. I'm out of state and I'm out of touch. Got a reckless heart and a beggar's knee. I could write a book,
he could write a book
about me. Well, I don't say much, but I love to talk. Got a funny way and a funny walk. Got a point of view that's hard to see. I could write a book,
he could write a book
about me. It's a hard story with soft cover. Every heart is double-spaced. For a bookmark, there's a bottle, so I don't lose my place.
I'm Gary Lee Miller, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. We're normally broadcast on Monday afternoons at 2 Eastern Time on the Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont. Our show features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors, and other people inside the world of books. Author Ellen Hopkins is a writer who doesn't shy away from difficult topics. Written in verse, her best-selling young adult novels take on issues ranging from drug addiction to sexual abuse, suicide to human trafficking. The explicit language and stark realism of Hopkins' books has drawn criticism from some adult readers, and the books have even been banned. But Hopkins insists that her work is never gratuitous and always honest. If it wasn't, she says, readers would lose their respect for her and wouldn't listen to what she has to say. Hopkins' most recent novel, Traffic, was published in November by Margaret K. McElderry Books. Traffic tells the story of five young people trying to escape from the world of domestic minor sex trafficking. In the book, Hopkins shows just how difficult such transitions can be. Her characters are young men and young women, gay and straight, urban and rural. They come from sheltered lifestyles and from broken homes, but what they share is the core desire of all young people, to be loved and to find a safe and meaningful place in the world. Ellen Hopkins was kind enough to share a bit of her world with me. Let's have a listen. Ellen Hopkins, thank you so much for being on Write the Book.
Oh, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
No problem. We're here to talk about your new book, Traffic. It follows young people who've been victims of domestic minor sex trafficking. And in the book, you give a pretty clear legal definition of that. I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about what that is for our listeners who aren't familiar.
It's moving young people under 18 into the sex trade. So, and it's done a few different ways, obviously, but coercion is one way. Enticement is another way. There are plenty of ways that it happens, but it's trafficking young people to use as prostitutes.
And what made you want to write about this topic?
Originally, so this Traffic is the sequel to Tricks, and that book, which is five young people from all different parts of the country that end up on the streets of Las Vegas working in the sex trade. My background is I was a freelance journalist, and then I went through nonfiction. So facts interest me, statistics interest me, and I came across the statistic that the average age of a young person trafficked into the sex trade is 12 years old.
Wow.
So for me, when I see something like that, I read something like that, then I need to know why. And then I start looking at the whys and trying to find stories and to talk to people who have been, you know, in this, who have had this issue affect them in whatever ways. So it's just, you know, we kind of overlooked this idea for a long, long time, and now we're looking at it a lot more heavily. You know, the FBI has a task force now that's looking at this specifically, and so we're starting to take it seriously that this is a big problem that we kind of didn't want to look at for a number of years.
Yeah, I think I get the impression a lot of people think, oh, you know, sex trafficking of minors is something that happens in other countries, but you know, how prevalent is it in the U.S.?
It is. The number is on any given day in this country 300,000 young people under 18 being trafficked.
That is unbelievable.
Yeah, and it's not just big cities. It doesn't just affect the major metropolitan areas. They move a lot of them. So there's like a circuit that they kind of move these young people along, so that they're not in one place too long, you know. But it happens in the Midwest. It happens in the Deep South. It's not just, you know, New York and L.A., which is what a lot of people would assume, I think.
And I imagine that this moving around is so that it makes it easier for them to avoid detection. Is that why they do it?
Correct, yeah. I mean, you know, there are different ways that they do it. There are different places. So, you know, there's gang involvement in some of that, which will kind of keep it in more localized. It is a big problem in New York City. I will say that for sure.
Sure.
In San Francisco and in Las Vegas. And, you know, now with the kind of the internet and being able to both recruit and advertise, you know, for sale through on, you know, just online, it can happen anywhere.
Right. You mentioned that you connected with people who told you their stories. How did you go about doing that? I mean, how did you reach out and find these young people who were willing to talk to you? Or maybe it was older people who'd you know, been involved when they were younger.
Well, with the first book, I spent time with Las Vegas Vice. So I actually talked to young people on the street. And it's interesting when, you know, because I'm not a threat. You know, I don't feel threatening. I'm not law enforcement, whatever. But they were more than willing to share stories and tell me how, you know, how they got there. And then later, I mean, now I have a pretty vast young adult audience. And when I wrote that book, then some of them would come and start sharing their stories with me through email or, you know, online venues through my social media and stuff. So it's both face-to-face and a lot of kind of that more anonymous, you know, through the internet, reaching out to me to share their stories. A lot of people, you know, most people, they want their stories to be heard. They want to be heard, you know, and I think this is a great way. Books allow them a voice that they otherwise might not have had. And to feel like somebody cares enough to write, you know, a story about people like them, then they feel freed to help, to tell their stories and to look for help, to ask for help.
Right. And a lot of your other books have also involved, you know, difficult issues with young people. Is there a specific reason? I mean, what made you drawn toward that topic, toward the topic of these difficult issues for young people?
First of all, I've raised three to adulthood. I have an 18-year-old in the house who thinks he's an adult, but he's not.
I'm familiar with that.
I'm around young people a lot, but also my first book, Crank, was inspired by my kid with everything, my genius kid who was going places, ended up addicted to crystal meth. And so for me, if this can happen to my kid, it could happen to anybody's kid, then it became
right.
Important to me to tell stories, to show young people maybe what could happen, what the possible outcomes to the choices that they make. And so then it just became, I don't know, a mission, I guess. but I, you know, I have a real respect for this generation, which is, it's the future, you know, it's our future. And they're faced with some heavy decisions every day and with things that are happening in their lives that aren't positive. You know, we always want to focus on the positive, but we can't always focus on the positive because
right.
The negative is what's going to take away that kind of positive future. So it just became important to me to give them a voice, to show them outcomes, to hopefully shape the future a little bit.
Right. So one of the things that really struck me about this book
is that I could imagine teenagers instantly being absorbed in it. I mean, I was pretty instantly absorbed in it. I have a 19-year-old daughter, and I'll be giving her this copy after, you know, after I'm done with it. And I think she would love this book. How do you think it is that you're able to connect? I mean, you're obviously, you have a huge readership among young adults, and I think a lot of the world tends to think of these kids as, you know, they're not readers. How is it that you're able to connect so well with them?
It's that, I don't know, it's that this is on the contemporary side, right? So this is all things that are happening to them or to people that they know or to, you know, relatives, friends, whatever. So to again, give them the respect to say, okay, I understand that this is happening to you or to your friends or whoever. And when a lot of adults kind of do, you know, they don't want to always look at that stuff, you know, and so, but you can't not. And so I just think that the fact that I do respect them, that I do offer their stories, that I do give them, and I don't write, I don't sugarcoat it, I don't make it, you know, prettier than it is, that strikes a chord with them because they know that I'm being honest with them. And I think that they like the idea of adults being honest with them and also kind of opening this line of communications that sometimes are closed to them.
Right. The book, and for those people who haven't read your books, they're written in verse. Why is it that you chose to use poetry instead of prose to talk to kids and to reach out to a young audience?
There are lots of reasons. With Crank specifically, so with the first one, I really wanted to write from her point, quote-unquote, her point of view rather than mine. I started the book in prose, and the voice was, it was my voice and not hers. It was angry, it was bitter, it was not what I wanted. And I've been writing poetry forever, and so I just decided to try to marry the two. There are other verse novelists working as well, but it worked for me very well with Crank specifically, which has a lot of kind of more interesting, unusual formatting, concrete poetry, a lot of kind of like scattering the words on the page, which worked like as her thought processes, you know what I mean?
Right.
So the poetry really, really was, it allowed me to tell a story in a way that it felt like how she was thinking. And that's what I found with verse, even as I've pulled away from that really dramatic formatting, that it allows you onto the page. Instead of feeling like you're being told a story, it's more like you're living the story. You become the characters or they become you, or you know what I mean? It's like you're seeing what they're seeing, you're thinking what they're thinking. And poetry works that way because it's imagery, it's sound, it's, you know, that's what it is. I like the challenge of making every word count. Every word is specifically there for a reason. And readers like that. And the white space on the page for a lot of kind of more reluctant readers or young people that feel like they don't like books, that white space allows them places to stop. It allows them, they like the more, the interesting visuals. So there are a lot of different reasons that I've stayed with verse, especially on the young adult side. But that's one of them. And when you deal with heavy subjects also, the white space, it's breathing room, you know, it's a place you can pause naturally.
Right. I don't know if it's still the case, but I can still remember when I was a teenager and my little sister had a whole box full of poems that she wrote. I know because I used to raid them and read them, which probably was not the nicest thing to do. And yes, I can still quote back to her, and I do, some of her lines. But she had a whole box, and they were all about, you know, her life and you know, what it is to grow up as a teenager.
Yeah, well, and poetry is, it's a way of expression. I mean, you know, it's like music, so it's a great way for young people to express themselves. You know, I've worked with some young people in some creative writing classes and stuff I've done with them, and, whoa, I mean, when they pull into that kind of, the rhythm and the idea that, you know, that it doesn't take big blocks of prose to be able to tell their stories, you know, you just get some amazing writing from them, you know, raps and I don't know, just, it's a great, the exercises that you can do with them are just amazing, and the stuff you can pull out of them this way, I think, it's fascinating.
Right. Your books have been really popular with teens. They haven't been as popular with some adults. Have you gotten? I think they've been criticized for their explicit nature, and et cetera. Is that true?
Oh, let's see. I'm almost always up there on the banned books list somewhere.
with pride, I think, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's like, and again, I think people who want to challenge books, who, for the most part, they have good intentions. You know what I mean? They really think that they're going to somehow save young people from these situations if they don't know that they exist, which is, I mean, it's ludicrous. You know, they exist in their lives every day. So if it's something like, okay, yeah, I might, all right, I use the F word in them. Because young people use the F word, you know what I mean? So, and it's not like I put it in there just to have it in there. It's like if a character would naturally use the word, then it's there, you know? And I can't not tell the stories correctly. I can't not be accurate with the portrayal of what I'm doing. You know, I've written childhood sexual abuse. You know, it's not a pretty topic, but it is an important topic. It happens, you know, and so I don't try to clean it up, because if I did, they would, first of all, my readers would call me on it. Second of all, it would not be showing them the respect that I was talking about, because this is what's happening and this is what it looks like. And this is maybe how we can stop this, or to give them the knowledge that they need to not put themselves in those situations. So for me to get challenged I don't like being banned. You know, I really don't. I mean, I think my books belong in libraries. I think they belong there because every kid deserves to see themselves in a book somewhere. They do. And so, yeah, I upset some adults, and I'm pretty outspoken about my beliefs and whatever, but it's important to me to show my readers that I care about them, that this is who I am, that this is, you know, something that matters to me and to a lot of adults, not just, you know, it's not just me. Otherwise, they wouldn't be books, you know. I mean, I have a publisher, I have an editor, and these subjects matter to a lot of different people.
Right. I have to say, having just read this book, that I felt like, you know, it was very honest, but I didn't see gratuitous, you know, anything in there. You know, I felt like you did a good job in you know, anything that was said was suitable to the character, or, you know, being honest about the character's situation. But I guess that's not how some people view it. And I think you're right. They think they are going to protect these kids. You know, if you don't read about it, it doesn't exist.
And what I would say to adults is, you know, why not read the books with your young people, you know,
right.
And be able to have those discussions, you know, because I know it's hard. It's hard for kids to talk to their parents anyway, and obviously it's hard for parents to talk to their kids, but this is an excellent way to be able to open up, you know, those lines of communication. And without those, you know, I mean, it's better to stay close to your kids and to help them maneuver this, you know, uneven landscape than it is to, like, just, you know, try to shut the door and keep them from going out into the world, because that's not going to work.
And it might even be easier since you're not, you know, if you're a parent and you're sitting down with this book and your child, you're not talking directly about any situation of your, you know, about your child's situation. You're talking about fictional children. And that may even make it easier, right?
Right, right. And I think absolutely that makes it easier. Absolutely.
Right.
And it works both ways, because, you know, I have young readers who the books help them understand their parents, you know, or what their parents have gone through, or, you know, why maybe they've lost a parent to addiction, or why a parent chose suicide. You know, I mean, these things happen. And to be able to understand them, and maybe even to develop some compassion and insight into people like that aren't like them, you know, like the kid that's over there, that, you know, why is that kid like that? To be able to have some kind of understanding of that, you know, hopefully we're mitigating the bullying situation in schools and stuff, because we can see, okay, you know what, that kid, he's doing those things for a reason. There's something bad going on in his life too. And I think that's really important as well. You know, I have had readers that have come to me and said, you know, after reading your books, now I want to go into social work. Now I want to become a psychologist. I want to become a drug counselor. I want to help other people. And I think that, you know, I mean, to me, that is so powerful. That's one of the things that I'm proudest of, is, you know, that I've encouraged young people to move forward, to help, want to help other young people. I think that's, like, amazing.
Now, what better response could a writer get?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Can we talk a little more specifically about Traffic? First of all, it's set in Las Vegas. Why did you choose Las Vegas as a setting?
Okay, I live in Nevada for one thing, but I live in the pretty part of North. But there was a big trafficking ring that was, it was actually busted in Reno. And but they were moving these kids from Reno to Las Vegas. So It's something I'm aware of as being a problem locally. Vegas to me kind of represents the trafficking trade. It is a big part of what's going on down there. I mean, all those big casinos, there are young people out in front of them. You know, they are, it's a hub for sure. And also it was available to me to be able to get there. So it worked well as the setting. But they, you know, this, again, these kids that they busted in Reno, they came from Minneapolis, they came from Dallas, you know, and they, so that's kind of where they moved them, and that's kind of that circle, Minneapolis, San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego, you know, and kind of around that way. So I was following that anyway in the news, and so it just made sense to me to set it there.
And the Vegas that you portray here, I noticed, is a little bit different from the one we see in the advertisements.
I imagine so. Although, I mean, it doesn't, all you have to do is go, you know, a block or two off the strip and you see it. It's not, it's right there.
It's not so hidden.
No, not at all. And, you know, this whole kind of Craigslist area of that, it's interesting when you go on to Craigslist or to some of these kind of, you know, internet sites, that you can tell by the wording of the ads, you know, sweet young thing, or, you know, it's
right,
it's easy to identify if you know what you're looking for,
right.
And here's the deal about this too, you know, there's market. If there wasn't a market, it wouldn't be a problem. So in Las Vegas, they're now looking at these young people as victims. They're decriminalizing them, and they're criminalizing their Johns and their pimps, and that's what we need to do. It's to look at how do we reduce the market for this, how do we get the pimps out of there, because, you know, they're the ones that are taking our young people and moving them into the sex trade. And so, like, we're putting some meat into kind of the sentencing now. So, like, in Nevada, if you're arrested for and convicted of moving a young person under the age of 14, that's a mandatory life sentence. So when you start putting some meat into the sentencing, hopefully we're going to, like, you know, at least mitigate the problem some.
Sure. One of the characters we meet early in the book is Ginger. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
Ginger has a mother who was working as a prostitute and on a couple of occasions actually sold her daughter to be used. So Ginger ends up running away when she discovers that her mother actually, you know, she thought she was raped, but her mother actually sent the guy to her and got paid for that. So she runs away, and then she ends up in Las Vegas stripping to make money because she has no skills. She's in high school. She has no other way to do it. So this is not something that doesn't happen. It does happen more often than you would think, that a parent actually does sell their child into the trade.
Right. I was wondering if maybe you could read a little bit from the opening of of the section where we meet Ginger.
Sure. So she has run away with a friend who ends up becoming a girlfriend, because for her, for Ginger also, she can't really stand the idea anymore of a man touching her, which is understandable, I think. But so she ends up with her girlfriend who moves into the business. Ginger won't do anything but strip, but Alex has moved into the, you know, total, immersed herself in the trade, I guess. And so here's a poem from Ginger. Will I walk away from here, this dirty city, where people come in search of lady luck? Certain she'll guide them to the fortune she owes them, or to shed their skins, reveal the extraordinary creatures beneath, aliens they struggle to conceal from spouses, ministers, their local PTA. Will I walk away from her, my best friend turned lover, before our tumble from enlightenment, if such a thing ever belonged to me? Can I excise her from my heart as easily as she deserted me? If I opened my arms, begged her to return, would she come back, or would she turn and run?
That's great. Thank you. You know, Alex is gay, and Ginger is bisexual, I guess. But, you know, there's a big segment of the kids in this book are, you know, from the LGBTQ population. Is it true that these kids are kids who often end up, you know, kind of in places like Las Vegas, or kind of cast out of their homes and forced to make really tough decisions about their lives?
It actually is. There are quite a few gay and trans kids that are on the streets, and it is because they've been discarded by their families in some way. And what do you do? I mean, what do you do when you're 15 years old and your parents have kicked you out because you're gay? You know, where are you going to go? You can't get a legitimate job. So what are you going to do? You end up on the street, and you end up hungry, and you end up that's what you can do to survive. It comes down to survival with them. It's pretty, I don't know, it's heart-wrenching, really. And it's something like 50,000 young people are on the street in this country right now, homeless, that have been homeless for 6 months or more, and on the street. And a majority of those are gay, actually.
Yep. I lived in Boston for many years, and right in the center of Harvard Square, literally right across from Harvard University, at the subway station, there was kind of a sunken plaza at the entrance of the subway, and it was known affectionately as the Pit. And the Pit was where all these kids, you know, were, all these homeless kids, you know, and I actually got to know some of them. I lived in an apartment where some of them had managed to scrape together enough money to live upstairs. But they had hard choices all the time.
They do, and they're great. When you get to know them, I mean, they're great. They're resilient. They want not only to survive. What it all comes down to, everybody wants love in their lives. I mean, that's what we need. That's what makes us thrive as humans. And, you know, sometimes, even looking for love, you end up doing things that you might not do otherwise, because you don't know when you're young how to find that place, how to find that person. And when you're out on the street, I mean, what else is there?
You know, yeah,
but they have...
Can we talk a little bit about how kids kind of get snared into trafficking? Like, what are some of the ways that happens?
And it happens. It can happen like that. It can happen that they're kicked out and there's nothing else. It can happen. I talked to one young lady who went into it because she wanted designer jeans and her family couldn't afford them. So she wasn't like doing it, you know, regularly. Just whenever she needed something, she would just that's how she, what she would do. She would, and she would run an ad, and she would pick up a guy, and she would have some money. There are kids who aren't kicked out of their house, but are lacking love at home, lacking attention at home. And so it's easy for, you know, a handsome pimp to move in on them. And pimps are patient. It's not like they're just, like, snatching them all off the street. They get them to fall in love with them, or they get them addicted to something. Or, I mean, there are lots of different ways that they put them in their debt. And sometimes it is that the kids fall in love with these guys, and then they'll do anything for them. And that happens more often than not. That's the way in. And then there is gang activity involved, so sometimes families trade them for drugs. Sometimes, you know, it's which sounds horrible, but it happens. And I talked to, young people that came to me at 10 years old, my mom sent me out because she was addicted to heroin or whatever. And then they get them addicted, and then there's no hope for them. You know, they feel like they don't know anything else. They can't do anything else. This is what's open to them. And so it's a psychological problem. So with survivorship, that's a problem too. And traffic is about survivorship. You know, tricks is kind of what gets them there onto the street. Traffic is, you know, can I get out? Is there life after? Can I find love again? Can I go home? But survivorship is possible. And that's what I hope this book shows and demonstrates, you know, well, that you can get out and you can have a life after.
Yes. At first, Ginger doesn't necessarily view herself as a victim. I think there's one point where she actually says something quite to that effect. Is that a common for kids, that they feel like it's their own fault?
I made the choice, so, you know, how can I be the victim if I decided that this is what I was going to do? And I would say one of the things that in fighting the minor sex trafficking is sex workers, you know, that are of age or whatever, a lot of them don't like the attention on it because they feel like that is their living. That is the way that they choose to make their living. For someone under 18, that's not really a choice. You know, it really is not. They often think that, again, you know, I have an 18-year-old. He thinks he's an adult. He thinks he knows everything. He thinks, you know, that all the choices he makes are his specifically, even though I'm paying for all. You know what I mean? It's like, there is coercion involved, even if it's making them fall in love or whatever. But they are victims, and that's what they need to understand. That, you know, that they are being victimized. And Ginger, she does say that. You know, the judge is telling her you're a victim, and she's like, I made this decision. I ran away from home. I started stripping for a living. You know, I'm not a victim, but she is.
Right. Do you think adults share that same view that a lot of adults do, that these kids aren't victims, that, you know, they made their bed, let them lie in it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, that's the way we've kind of looked at the sex trade anyway for depending on what part, where we are, where our lives are, you know. It's frustrating to me to talk to these young people that, you know, that they feel like that's the only way that the only thing they have, and then to have adults, you know, well, that is their choice. You know, they made their bed or whatever. And it's kind of a disdain, I think, for tough choices, that sometimes there aren't, you know, there are only so many choices that you can make in those situations. So it's not, you know, that's why I hope adults will read my books too, and especially these books, and come to understand what's at stake for the kids and why they end up there, and then, you know, how we can help them as adults get out, how we can, you know, see something and go, you know what, that's not right, and make a call somewhere to help get these kids off the street instead of just saying, oh, you know, I don't want anything to do with people like that.
Sure. What are some of the obstacles that stand in the way of these kids getting out once they're in?
a lot of times they drop out of school, so then they have to go back and then they have to catch up on their education. You know, rescue services are very good about helping them do that, helping them into jobs. You know, it's if people find out about their past, it's harder for them to get jobs. If there's an addiction value to that, then they have to get clean. And they just have to find the support to get out, you know, and which is why it's really hard to do on their own. They need someone, they need adults in their lives that are telling them, I'm going to help you, we will help you get out. And there are ways for them to get out. There are rescue services, there are support systems that are in place. We could use more, you know what I mean? It's like every city should have something like that in place instead of just, you know, well, we'll have to send you over there instead. But as we're recognizing this problem, we're finding more and more support systems and putting more and more in place.
And often these kids face real danger in trying to get out if they...
They do. That's you know, if there's gang activity involved, if they've been tattooed and branded, and they are like that. You know, there are some of these pimps they're pretty vicious. Which is another reason why we need to get the pimps off the streets. We need to, you know, put, you know, the meat into the sentencing on them and get them, pull them off, so we can get the kids out from underneath them. And it is very hard, especially if there's parents involved, and sometimes there are. So, and again, it's like there are different areas of the business, and some are pretty violent and vicious.
Ginger, you know, she ends up at a shelter called House of Hope, but then, you know, she can't stay there forever, and she'll end up going home, and she faces a really hard situation.
Indeed. I mean, her mother is dying of AIDS, which, and the forgiveness for her mother, that's been a very, very difficult thing for her. But then she also comes to understand that her mother had choice taken away from her when she was younger too. You know, this can be self-perpetuating. And she goes back, and then she's got to go back and just try to be a regular kid. How do you go back to high school if, you know, this has been your life for a year? Or 2 years, or whatever. How do you go back and just, you know, you're going to go to prom? You know, what are you going to do? And so, luckily, she has a grandmother who's willing to help her, but not every kid has that.
Right. Cody is another character in the book. He's actually the character who opens the book quite dramatically, as a matter of fact. He's going to have an even harder return home, I think. He's been shot by a prostitute's angry boyfriend and paralyzed from the waist down. Where did you come up with the idea for Cody?
And Cody, you know, in the first book, he's just this kid from Kansas who develops a gambling habit and is sucking his mother's bank account down. You know, he doesn't mean to do it. It's not, you know, this is something, in fact, he fought, you know, going into the business to be able to, like, pay his mom back, basically, is put money back in the bank that she needed to survive herself. But this happens, you know, I mean, it's like a lot of these kids do end up hurt or dead and dumped, you know, they get dumped. So for him, at the end of Tricks, you know, he's been shot. And so, yeah, it's funny, when I never planned sequels to books when I write them originally.
Right.
But eventually, sometimes reader demand or whatever is like, okay, I have to write a sequel to this book. And so when I decided I was going to write Traffic, I threw it out to my readers, so who has to come back? And, you know, everybody had different ideas, but all of them had to come back. So to bring Cody back and just, you know, have him dance away was not going to work. So, and also, he was the one that really didn't want to work in the original book. You know what I mean? He was
right.
Like kind of this lazy kid who just like blah, blah, blah. And so now he's going to have to work really hard to get a life back together. And spinal cord injury is something, you know, I wanted the element in there too, because I wanted to show that, you know what, sometimes the fight to come back is a real, real fight. And so for him, that's what that's going to be. It's going to be a fight for the rest of his life because of a choice, a bad, bad choice he made, you know. And I tell young people this, too. It's like, you can make these choices, and, you know, we can forgive some choices, but sometimes the outcomes of the choices you make are going to affect your life in whatever ways forever and ever. And so for him, he's going to be fighting forever now.
Home for Cody is a single mom and a brother who's already served time in prison. Do most or all kids who are victims of trafficking come from this kind of broken home kind of scenario? Or are there kids who come from, you know, families that at least from the outside we would view as, you know, quite together and, you know, quite together families?
Well, Whitney, you know, she comes from a wealthy family, and for her, her whole thing was that she always thought her mom loved her sister, and that was a together family, but she always thought her mom loved her sister more, and she was always looking for attention that she didn't feel like she was getting, and so she became an easy target for a pimp to move in, and again, to have her fall in love with him, because even in traffic, when she's away from him, she gets a chance to go back to him, and she does. That's the first thing she does. Even though she's gotten clean, she's gotten, you know, off her addiction and whatever, but that kind of like all-encompassing young love thing can go so wrong, you know, in a situation like that. But no, they pick up kids like the Mall of America in Minneapolis is one of their prime target spots because it's so huge. And so like these kids get separated from their parents and whatever, and it's one of their big recruitment places, which I thought was really interesting because, you know, that's it seems like such a clean city, you know what I mean?
Right.
So no, these kids come from all different kinds of backgrounds. They really do. And money isn't, you know, that isn't the benchmark. Religion isn't the benchmark, you know, gender identity. None of these things are bench. I mean, they happen to all of them across the board.
Right. And Whitney, as you mentioned, suffers, you know, from an addiction. So it's almost like she's doubly addicted. She's addicted to this person who has, you know, none of her best interests in mind, but she's also addicted to a drug. I'm guessing that's pretty common, that a pimp would, you know, introduce a young man or woman to drugs as a method of keeping them under control.
It absolutely is. It's definitely one of their ways of keeping them. Because when you know, especially when it's a heroin addiction or a meth addiction, it's going to be something that is so much hold on you that you will do anything for that, you know, the next high, the next fix, whatever. And so when you have no other resources, what are you going to do? And pimps definitely use drugs as a way to hang on to these kids, you know, to bring them in, and, you know, and you introduce it a little at a time, you know, let's just get a little buzz on, oh, that was fun, let's try a little more, let's try something harder, let's try something different, and then it becomes like, and now this is going to take all your pain away, this is going to make everything better, and those drugs are highly addictive, and it's a tool, you know, it's a way of keeping them under control.
And it seems it makes it doubly hard for kids for more than one reason, because all this, you know, just like there's a stigma around, you know, prostitution, there's a stigma around addiction that brings these kids great shame, may cause their families to reject them, things like that.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, and like you said, when it's doubly a problem, you know, when they're compounding the problem with the addiction, then it's just that much harder to get out of again. Because then the going home, you know, also involves getting clean, and that's not always an easy thing either. Sometimes it's just easier just to go back, you know. Like one of my readers. And sometimes I develop relationships with them without even really wanting to. But this one, she keeps coming back, and she's fascinating to me that because she keeps going back to the drug, even though she hates what it does to her, you know.
Right.
And it's like but she can't stop. You know, she'll see an old friend, and then she'll have to, like, just one more time, you know, and then she's back into it until she has to go back into rehab again. And it's the cycle. It's a vicious cycle. It's even as much as she wants out, she won't let herself get out. You know, I keep going, why do you do that? She's like, I don't know. You know, it's interesting. Maybe it's because I don't have that addictive pull, you know, that addictive drive or whatever. So I don't think if you don't have that, it's really hard to understand that. But again, I think that's why to create books as spaces that we can learn to understand the stuff without actually maybe going out and doing it.
Sure.
I think that's a really good thing for books to do for young people and for adults.
Ellen Hopkins, thanks so much for talking to me. We're almost out of time here, and I want to thank you for all the great stuff you've done for kids, for all your books that are helping kids and parents understand these big issues a little better. I was wondering if we could close by you maybe giving us a little bit of advice about, you know, now that we understand this problem of trafficking, you know, minors in the sex trade, what's something the average person can do?
There are signs, okay? So, first of all, there are signs if it's your kid. If your kid has been, you know, this kid that you've known forever, and all of a sudden the grades are slipping, or there's new friends involved, or they're not going to school like they should or whatever, you need to be vigilant about that. As just strangers to that, if you suspect, if you see somebody on the street, you know, where you are kind of regularly and it doesn't look right to you, there are hotlines, and in the back of traffic I have resources, I have places you can call, but there are hotlines, so you can just anonymously call and say, look, I think this is going on, or if it looks like, you know, the guy across the street, you know, is moving young people in there, and you can see people going in and out, or, you know, I think it's important that we get involved rather than, you know, we kind of want to just hide behind our whatever and not, but without that, without involvement from kind of the outside, this stuff is going to proliferate, and we can help stop that, and I think it's important that you do get involved, even if it's anonymously, whatever you can do, if you see a situation that looks wrong, to say something before it gets worse.
Ellen Hopkins, thank you so much for being on Write the Book. Her wonderful book is Traffic, and it's about domestic minor sex trafficking in the U.S., it's a fantastic book. Thank you so much, and take care.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Ellen Hopkins, author of Traffic, published in 2015 by Margaret K. McElderry Books. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crowe's Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mules, custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crowe's Trading Post on Facebook. Here's the Bookworm calendar for the coming week. Salman Rushdie, Tuesday, December 15th, 1 to 2 p.m. Salman Rushdie's Haroon and the Sea of Stories sparks a lively dialogue at Burnham Memorial Library in Colchester. Wednesday, December 16th, 6:30 to 9 p.m., Bibliophiles join Ed Cashman for a shared meal and conversation about a selected literary work. Call for details at Brown Library in Essex Junction. Friday, December 18th at 6 p.m., scholar and activist Jackson Wright Schultz reads from his new books, Trans Portraits, Voices from Transgender Communities, at the Main Street Museum in White River Junction. I personally love the Main Street Museum. It's a great place. For this week's writing exercise, let's take a page from Ellen Hopkins, who writes novels in verse. You have two options. First, you could take an existing prose scene that you've already written and rewrite it in verse, or you could write a completely new scene in verse instead of prose. No need to use rhyme or any formal scheme, but if sonnets are your thing, you can let it fly. Thanks for listening to Write the Book. If you're interested in sharing the show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com, and those podcasts are free. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and the Write the Book radio show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at the website of Write the Book host, Shayla Shapiro, and that URL is shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest, comments about the show, or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. The theme song for this episode of Write the Book is by Possum. You can find them on Facebook. I'm Gary Lee Miller, and you can find more about me at GaryLeeMiller.com. I'm looking forward to more great book talk, and I hope you'll be here to join me. This has been Write the Book, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.
It's a hard story with a soft cover. Every heart is double-spaced for bookmark. There's a bottle so I don't lose my place. Well, I get too high or I get too low. Stay out of late or just don't go. Say what you want, I'll disagree. I could write a book.
He could write a book
about me. Yeah, I could write a book.
He could write a book
about me.